cuttlefish. They don the accoutrements of a sensitive and non-threatening male via their ideological commitment oozing with progressive empathy. In a sense, this is akin to the sensitive guy who befriends women and offers them endless emotional support, with the hope that it eventually pays off romantically. Back in the 1980s, John Hughes was responsible for many of the iconic teenage-themed movies of that era, including 16 Candles, The Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Pretty in Pink. In the latter classic movie, Andy Walsh, played by Molly Ringwald, is a working-class teenager with a romantic interest in Blaine McDonough, played by Andrew McCarthy, a rich kid from the proverbial better side of the tracks. Andy's best friend, Ducky, played by John Cryer, who later gained renewed fame in the TV series Two and a Half Men, is the epitome of the sneaky fucker friend. Always there offering his endless sensitive support, hoping that he will eventually be given his due chance at romance. Returning to the male social justice warriors, it is clear that most do not look anything like Navy SEALs. In other words, they do not exhibit the morphological features associated with physical formidability and social dominance. There is growing scientific evidence that men's economic and political outlooks, what they think about economic redistribution, military intervention, and other topics, are associated with their physical strength. Those who are stronger and more physically formidable are less likely to support egalitarianism and more likely to support military intervention. Irrespective of whether male social justice warriors truly believe their stated ideological positions or are merely faking it as a sneaky fucker mating strategy, it is clear that men's morphological features do indeed serve as signature of their socio-political outlooks. Self-flagellating at the altar of progressivism. There is another motive or two behind progressivism. Many of the progressive positions espoused by SJWs are a form of self-flagellation, meant to atone for some assumed original sin, most likely being a white Westerner, and to highlight one's virtuous ideological progressive purity. In this sense, SJW progressivism can almost be seen as an alternative religion to Christianity. The Name of the Rose remains to this day one of my all-time favorite movies. It features Sean Connery and a very young Christian Slater, surrounded by a powerful cast of medieval characters. The story takes place in the 14th century at an Italian Benedictine monastery, where several individuals have recently died under mysterious circumstances. It is a classic whodunit set against the backdrop of the religious zealotry of the Middle Ages under the ever-watchful eyes of the all-powerful Inquisition authorities. More than 30 years have elapsed since I first saw this brilliant film, and yet many of its iconic scenes remain etched in my memory, perhaps none more so than the assistant librarian, Berengar of Arundel, self-flagellating as penance for his homosexuality and for the guilt at having caused the suicide of Adelmo of Otranto, with whom he traded sex for access to a desired book. The theological tenet that one's guilt could be expunged via various forms of self-mortification, including self-flagellation, exists in numerous religious traditions. The Catholic flagellants of the Middle Ages engaged in public self-flagellation, both to atone for their sins, but also as a conspicuous act of extreme piety, and in some cases to ward off great calamities, such as the Black Death. Signaling one's religious purity and commitment in this way is costly and handicapping, but done in public, it surely makes a more conspicuous case for one's virtue than saying three Hail Marys in a church. Social justice warriors and various assorted progressive brethren are typically privileged white Westerners. In their warped sense of the world, this is akin to being born with original sin as postulated in Christian doctrine. They must atone for the sin of not having been born poor persons of color in the third world. Thus, they might seek penance in a form of ideological self-flagellation. Rather than using a whip or chain to self-harm, they adopt a progressive mindset that is ultimately harmful to them and their society. Take, for example, the ethos of infinite tolerance. The great philosopher Karl Popper offered perhaps the greatest take on such a mindset. Less well-known is the paradox of tolerance. Unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed, and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies, as long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them, if necessary, even by force. For it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim, in the name of tolerance, the right not to tolerate the intolerant. Infinite tolerance causes Western governments to exhibit reticence to prosecute and ultimately punish returning ISIS fighters. Rather, they seek to reintegrate these brutal individuals into our societies by providing them with job opportunities and enrolling them in, quote, de-radicalization programs. In the words of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who has fought Islamist intolerance, tolerance of intolerance is cowardice. Beto O'Rourke was among a very large contingent of candidates running for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 United States presidential election. O'Rourke exemplifies the mindset of a male social justice warrior. His campaign consisted largely of a grotesque apology tour of self-flagellation. He apologized for being male, for being white, and for being privileged. He announced that some of his ancestors owned slaves, an admission of guilt by intergenerational association. While watching one of his blubbering admissions of, quote, guilt on the insufferable television show The View, my wife turned to me and remarked that she could not understand why anyone would vote for Beto the Beta. Therein lies the incongruity between progressive self-flagellants and the rest of us. What they consider introspectively virtuous and pious, we view as weak and self-loathing. No leader should exhibit such cowardly traits, and certainly not one who hopes to hold the most powerful post in the world. Self-loathing is an affliction that plagues many people. It is a recurring theme in psychotherapy, where the goal is to alter an individual's mindset such that they develop a healthy sense of self-worth. Innumerable self-help books exist to address this malady in various ways. Saturday Night Live satirized the plague of self-loathing via its recurring sketch, Daily Affirmations with Stuart Smalley, played by Al Franken, the Minnesota senator who resigned in 2018 amidst the hysteria of the hashtag MeToo movement. Perhaps the best-known catchphrase from this series was, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. While the segment was comical, no clinical psychologist worth her salt would posit that self-loathing is a desirable state. And that lies at the heart of the extraordinary contradiction facing the West. While liberals know it is a virtue to overcome self-loathing at the individual level, they believe it is also a virtue to wallow in self-loathing at the group level. I hate my white identity. I hate my Western culture. I hate my Christian roots. Angela Merkel's astounding open border policy, granting close to 1 million Muslim immigrants entry into Germany, could be seen as self-flagellation for Germany's historical transgressions. Laced with typical progressive lunacy, what better way to make up for the Holocaust than by admitting, quote, refugees who frequently exhibit genocidal hatred of Jews? A similar form of self-flagellation is taking place among American progressives when it comes to the current illegal immigration crisis at the U.S. border. Why are Central Americans coming to the United States? According to social justice warriors and their ilk, it's because the United States caused their societies to collapse via imperialistic meddling. So, in self-flagellating recompense, we owe the noble, undocumented immigrants free entry into the United States. Beto O'Rourke went one better than that and suggested that Central Americans were fleeing the ravages of climate change and the United States is supposedly a key culprit. All roads lead to self-flagellation. It is the only progressive path to redemption. The reflex to collective self-flagellation is causing several candidates for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination to proclaim their support for reparations for African Americans, prostrating themselves before such great moral arbiters as Al Sharpton. Senator Elizabeth Warren expanded the discussion of reparations to gay couples. Some entrepreneurial merchants of victimhood have seized on this opportunity. Cameron Witten has organized a reparations happy hour in, where else? Portland, Oregon, where white people pay for drinks for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people, but don't attend the event because their white presence might be too triggering. If paying for drinks does not redress your white guilt, you can enroll in the Race to Dinner program. You get to invite two women of color, Regina Jackson and Sarah Rao, to dinner to bear witness to their pain. If drinks and dinners prove insufficient in curbing your white guilt, you can enroll in a yoga seminar in Seattle to detoxify from your whiteness. My family escaped execution in Lebanon, and we escaped from slavery in ancient Egypt. How much am I owed in reparations? In order to espouse their endless, irrational positions while maintaining a straight face, social justice warriors must ignore, deny, or reject reality. Progressivism has become an enemy of reason. Chapter 6. Departures from Reason, Ostrich Parasitic Syndrome. Most men would rather deny a hard truth than face it. George R. R. Martin. The easiest way to solve a problem is to deny it exists. Isaac Asimov. The human brain can protect us from seeing and feeling what it believes may be too uncomfortable for us to tolerate. It can lead us to deny, defend, minimize, or rationalize away something that doesn't fit our worldview. Bandy X. Lee. Science should be about the pursuit of truth, and not about the defense of one's preferred political ideology or personal beliefs. Richard Lowenton and the late Stephen Jay Gould, two eminent Harvard scientists, were staunch critics of sociobiology, a precursor to evolutionary psychology, in part because it did not adhere to their Marxist worldviews. Their animus toward their Harvard colleague E.O. Wilson, a leading figure of sociobiology, became part of the greater culture war that raged on university campuses in the 1970s. But perhaps the greatest clash between Marxism and science was orchestrated in the Soviet Union by the agronomist Trofim Lysenko. He rejected the established mechanisms of heredity, Mendelian inheritance, and instead proposed his pseudoscientific theories that were perceived as consistent with Marxist collectivism. Under the leadership of Joseph Stalin, this allowed him to gain great political and scientific influence, including the capacity to severely punish contrarian Soviet scientists who dared to critique his quackery. His rejection of established theories in genetics went beyond the murder of truth. It led to agricultural practices in the Soviet Union and in China that arguably led to the starvation of millions of people. Anti-vaccine activism is a modern-day version of Lysenkoism. In 1998, Andrew Wakefield published a paper in the leading medical journal, The Lancet, the article has since been retracted, that supposedly demonstrated a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR, vaccine, and autism. It served as a powerful catalyst for the ensuing anti-vax movement, led by several Hollywood celebrities, perhaps most notably by the actress Jenny McCarthy, whose son suffers from autism. Few parents want to accept that their child might have been born with a predisposition to autism. It is psychologically much more comforting to blame an environmental agent. This is particularly tempting in the case of autism, which is commonly diagnosed around the same time that children receive the MMR vaccine, prompting some parents to draw an illusory link between the two events, and even to conclude, hopefully, that if the MMR vaccine caused autism, there might be an easy fix to reverse the condition. The pediatrician and virologist Paul A. Offit has been at the forefront of combating the anti-vaxxers, writing several books about the dangers of denying vaccine science and relying on celebrities and politicians for health recommendations. Researchers have found that almost half of the advice offered on shows like The Dr. Oz Show and The Doctors either had no scientific basis or was contrary to existing scientific evidence. One of my most popular Psychology Today articles dealt with the problem of celebrities talking about scientific issues. If a large segment of the population decides to refrain from vaccinating their kids because Jenny McCarthy has shared, quote, her truth, we have a problem. We have personal anecdotes versus science with potentially deadly consequences as children are needlessly exposed to dangerous viruses. By emphasizing the scientific consensus against the anti-vax quackery, one can reverse this dangerous instantiation of science denialism. Ostrich parasitic syndrome. Of course, the desire to deny reality extends far beyond science. The human capacity for deception and self-deception is enormous. In fact, some scientists suspect one reason our intelligence evolved as it has is so we can successfully manipulate others. In the service of such manipulative intent, we have evolved a parallel proclivity to self-deceive, which protects us from betraying our duplicity. The first step in being a good liar is believing the lie. While these evolutionarily based reasons for deception yield adaptive benefits, there is one form of self-deception that seems rather peculiar. At times, we deny facts that are as evident as the existence of the moon. The father of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, noted the human capacity to suppress unpleasant information and referred to it as this ostrich policy. This human ostrich effect, based on the comic image of an ostrich burying its head in the sand to avoid unwelcome realities, a behavior the ostrich doesn't actually exhibit in nature, has been documented in many contexts, including financial investments. Several years ago, when I realized that idea pathogens were causing more and more people to reject reality, I coined the term ostrich parasitic syndrome, OPS. Here's how I defined this dreadful attack on reason. This disorder causes a person to reject realities that are otherwise as clear as the existence of gravity. Sufferers of OPS do not believe their lying eyes. They construct an alternate reality known as unicornia. In such a world, science, reason, rules of causality, evidentiary thresholds, a near infinite amount of data, data analytic procedures, inferential statistics, the epistemological rules inherent to the scientific method, rules of logic, historical patterns, daily patterns, and common sense are all rejected. Instead, the delusional ramblings of an OPS sufferer are rooted in illusory correlations, non-existent causal links, and feel-good progressive platitudes. Ostrich logic is always delivered via an air of haughty moral superiority. I once visited a physician because I was suffering recurring bouts of bronchitis. As I sat in his office, he was chain-smoking. I asked him if that was a good idea while treating an asthmatic patient suffering from bronchitis. He laughed it off. I share this story to remind people that experts are not immune from poor judgment and faulty reasoning. Notwithstanding the fact that I coined OPS, I have myself succumbed to ostrich logic by thinking that if I ignore my weight gain, it will go away, instead of leaving me 30 pounds heavier. 6 degrees of faux causality. Those infected with OPS succumb to a broad range of cognitive biases as a means of protecting them from reality. One of them involves ascribing an illusory network of connectedness between variables. Many important phenomena in our daily lives are organized as networks, be it the small world phenomenon, human connectedness, the neurons in our brains, connected to one another via synapses, the World Wide Web, electric power grids, social networks like Facebook, or biological systems. That our world consists of an endless number of interconnected elements has led to the so-called butterfly effect, the idea that a small perturbation in the starting conditions of a system could yield substantial downstream effects. While it is indeed true that our world is composed of countless networks of interconnected parts, the problem arises when people construct networks of faux causality to explain a given phenomenon. For example, in 2015, Bill Nye, a self-described science guy, found a way to connect an Islamist terror attack in Paris to climate change, saying, "It's very reasonable to conclude that the recent trouble in Paris is a result of climate change. There is a water shortage in Syria. This is fact-based. Small and medium farmers have abandoned their farms because there's not enough water, not enough rainfall. And especially the young people who have not grown up there, have not had their whole lives invested in living off the land. The young people have gone to the big cities looking for work. There's not enough work for everybody, so the disaffected youths, as we say, the young people who don't believe in the system, believe the system has failed, don't believe in the economy, are more easily engaged and more easily recruited by terrorist organizations. And then they end up partway around the world, in Paris, shooting people." You can make a very reasonable argument that climate change is not that indirectly related to terrorism. It's related to terrorism. So this is just the start of things. The more we let this go on, the more trouble there's going to be. You can say, "We'll stamp out the terrorists, but everybody's leaving their farms because of water shortages." That's a little bigger problem. One wonders why Chile has not produced a greater number of terrorists, given that one of the most arid places on Earth is its Atacama Desert. But through the magic of assumed connectedness, you can link anything to anything if you're not bound by logic and fact-based rules of causality. Why do individuals succumb to such shoddy thinking? In his book, The Conduct of Inquiry, the philosopher Abraham Kaplan wrote, "In addition to the social pressures from the scientific community, there is also at work a very human trait of individual scientists. I call it the law of instrument, and it may be formulated as follows. Give a small boy a hammer, and he will find that everything he encounters needs pounding. It comes as no particular surprise to discover that a scientist formulates problems in a way which requires for their solution just those techniques in which he himself is especially skilled." The humanist psychologist Abraham Maslow, in The Psychology of Science, added, "I suppose it is tempting, if the only tool you have is a hammer, to treat everything as if it were a nail." This is very much related to the notion of methodological fixation, which occurs when researchers become single-minded about the use of specific data collection or data analytic procedures, irrespective of their suitability for a given research problem. If you are a climate activist, all calamities are due to man-made climate change. If you are a radical feminist, the patriarchy, along with toxic masculinity, are to blame. Perhaps not surprisingly, climate change has been blamed on toxic masculinity. If you are a member of the diversity, inclusion, and equity cult, then naturally all ills stem from a lack of diversity, inclusion, and equity. If you are a member of the Democratic Party, all problems originate with Donald Trump. In the philosophy of science, the principle of Occam's razor means that all things being equal, simple explanations should be preferred to convoluted ones, a useful guard against the faulty epistemology of faux causality. In his Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, Sir Isaac Newton proclaimed, "We are to admit no more causes of natural things than such as are both true and sufficient to explain their appearances." To this purpose, the philosophers say that nature does nothing in vain, and more is in vain when less will serve, for nature is pleased with simplicity and affects not the pomp of superfluous causes. The problem with those who succumb to the 6 degrees of faux causality trap is that they generate long sequences of illusory causal pathways. This can be necessary if you spout progressive platitudes that are manifestly untrue. Open borders. Diversity is our strength. Of all the platitudinous slogans uttered by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, he is undoubtedly best known for repeatedly invoking the mantra, "Diversity is our strength." He appears to believe that any problem is solved by simply repeating his slogan enough times that the problem disappears. Increasing diversity is the solution to all challenges, be they economic, social, political, environmental, or related to security. Simply double down on the cultural, ethnic, and religious diversity of the massive influx of immigrants into Canada and watch as we all eventually hold hands in brotherly unison while singing John Lennon's Imagine. This is the type of ostrich logic that is destroying the future of the West. There are many forms of cultural enrichment, including restaurants of varied cuisines, that come from living in a heterogeneous and pluralistic society. But the cultural and religious values that some immigrants bring with them to the West manifestly do not add to our strength. They only sow hatred, intolerance, and divisiveness. My good friend Professor Salim Mansour testified eloquently on this in front of the Standing Committee on Citizenship and Immigration in the Canadian House of Commons on October 1, 2012. The flow of immigration into Canada from around the world, and in particular the flow from Muslim countries, means a pouring in of numbers into a liberal society of people from cultures at best non-liberal. But we know through our studies and observation that the illiberal mix of cultures poses one of the greatest dilemmas and an unprecedented challenge to liberal societies such as ours, when there is no demand placed on immigrants any longer to assimilate into the founding liberal values of the country to which they have immigrated. Instead, a misguided and thoroughly wrong-headed policy of multiculturalism encourages the opposite. We may want to continue with a level of immigration into Canada annually that is about the same as it is at present. We cannot, however, continue with such an inflow of immigrants under the present arrangement of the official policy of multiculturalism based on the premise that all cultures are equal, when this is untrue. This policy is a severe, perhaps even a lethal, test for a liberal democracy such as ours. We should not allow bureaucratic inertia to determine not only the policy, but the existing level of immigrant numbers and source origin that Canada brings in annually. We have the precedent of how we selectively closed immigration from the Soviet bloc countries during the Cold War years, and we need to consider doing the same in terms of immigration from Muslim countries for a period of time, given how disruptive is the cultural baggage of illiberal values that is brought in as a result. We are, in other words, stoking the fuel of much unrest in our country, as we have witnessed of late in Europe. Lest any member wants to instruct me that my views are in any way politically incorrect or worse, I would like members to note that I come before you as a practicing Muslim who knows out of experience, from the inside, how volatile, how disruptive, how violent, how misogynistic is the culture of Islam today and has been during my lifetime, and how it greatly threatens our liberal democracy that I cherish, since I know what is its opposite. It is difficult to argue that Mansour is a bigoted white supremacist Islamophobe, given that he is a brown man of Indian descent and a practicing Muslim. He is an honest man who recognizes that all cultures are not equally liberal. The idea that unrestrained diversity is a magical elixir when it comes to creating stable and peaceful societies is a profoundly imbecilic notion. Science tells us that, generally speaking, homophily, being attracted to those who are similar, has been documented in a very broad range of social contexts. For instance, if marital success is your ultimate objective, then the research is very clear. Choose someone who is similar to you. We also choose our friends partly based on genetic homophily, our dogs based on morphological homophily, and our global trade partners based on cultural homophily. It follows that when it comes to immigration, people who share foundational values are more likely to get along than those who don't. If you are a classically liberal, modern, pluralistic, and secular society, opening your door to innumerable immigrants whose cultural and religious heritage is rooted in religious supremacy, homophobia, misogyny, intolerance toward religious minorities with a special hatred for Jews, rejection of freedom of speech, and freedom of conscience, will not yield good outcomes. To state this is not bigoted. It is recognizing a reality as clear as the existence of the sun. Reciprocal altruism is an evolved mechanism. The West grants entry to a manageable number of refugees, fully expecting that they will reciprocate our generosity by adopting our secular, liberal, and modern values. Suicidal empathy is not. We should never compromise the fabric of our modern societies in order to engage in a pious exercise of civilizational self-flagellation. I say this as a proud Canadian immigrant. Those who repeatedly hurl racist at anyone who seeks to discuss rational immigration policies suffer from an insidious form of ostrich parasitic syndrome. Nothing to do with Islam. Since the September 11, 2001, Islamist terrorist attacks on the United States, Islamic terrorists have perpetrated more than 35,000 attacks across the globe. The attacks have occurred in nations that vary on every conceivable metric, including race, ethnicity, culture, religion, language, economic vitality, and political system. No other religion has come even remotely close to Islam in inspiring, justifying, or supporting terrorism. And yet, the progressive intelligentsia insist that none of these documented attacks have anything to do with Islam. Instead, a bewildering number of other, quote, causes have been offered. Before I delve into some of these supposed causes, it is worth noting that the obfuscation starts with the use of fantastical euphemisms and misdirection in referring to the terror attacks. Apparently, the terror attacks are senseless acts of random violence. They are unprovoked, non-ideological mass murder. They are a manifestation of homegrown extremism. They are instantiations of criminality or workplace violence. And as Barack Obama's administration reminded us all, they are man-made disasters. The perpetrators of these man-made disasters are supposedly pushed to commit these heinous attacks because they are disenfranchised, marginalized, alienated, isolated, desperate, or humiliated. Furthermore, they lack hope, purpose, or meaningful relationships. They are social losers or family rejects. Many are, quote, lone wolves. Many are also young. Who amongst us did not head off to Raqqa in his youth to join ISIS and throw gays off rooftops? It's youthful indiscretion. Other root causes range from climate change to toxic masculinity to violent video games to Western colonialism to the Crusades. Apparently, revenge is a dish best served really cold. In fact, to progressives, anything, except for the obvious thing, Islamic doctrines, can be a root cause of Islamist terrorism. The noble faith must be protected at all costs. How ostrich parasitic syndrome sufferers protect Islam. There are innumerable cognitive biases to which OPS sufferers succumb in their desperate attempts to reject any honest criticism of Islam. Humans have evolved a preference for trusting the veracity of personal anecdotes over, quote, cold aggregate data. We are a storytelling animal, and as such, our personal experiences carry great weight in shaping our views of the world. Now, imagine that I am a Muslim individual who was raised by parents who are loving, kind, and tolerant. They have never harbored a single Jew-hating sentiment in their lives. They are well-respected members of their mosque. It becomes very easy for such an individual to argue that his parents exemplify true Islam. This yields two forms of ostrich logic, namely the hashtag not all Muslims canard, my father, brother, uncle, friend, Ahmed is Muslim, and he is a very kind, peaceful, tolerant, and liberal individual, and the unicorn Islam fallacy. But true Islam is a feminist religion that loves Jews and gays, and it supports freedom of conscience. Islam is a system of beliefs. Many Muslims pick and choose the parts that they wish to adhere to, and reject those parts that they find objectionable. That your friend Ahmed eats pork and drinks whiskey says nothing about whether Islam permits these behaviors or not. Similarly, the imposition of your personal morality onto your religion does not alter its contents. That your Muslim parents taught you to love and respect Jews says nothing about whether Islam cherishes or despises Jews. In 2010, a Canadian Jewish friend contacted me by email to help her better understand Islam, and specifically whether it contained doctrines of hate. At the time, she had a friend who was an apparently lovely Muslim woman who was pursuing a PhD at a leading Canadian university. As commonly occurs with folks infected with OPS, My friend was having a difficult time reconciling her personal interaction with a liberal and peaceful Muslim with the growing evidence of never-ending global mayhem inflicted in the name of Islam. Among much else, I sent her a montage of clips demonstrating the profound Jew hatred found in Islamic societies, with children, politicians, imams, clerics, and television personalities spewing nearly unimaginable genocidal hate. Alas, she, along with her friend, responded with a tsunami of clichés. All religions have violent extremists. The Bible contains violent passages. Most Muslims are nice people. That amounted to a nonsensical apologia, and she ended one of our tense email exchanges with, "You're starting to sound fanatical yourself, Gad." Regrettably, she is hardly the only progressive Jew to engage in such disordered thinking when it comes to Islam. The deflect strategy which she employed is a very common progressive defense of Islam. By pointing to ugly realities elsewhere, progressives hope to absolve Islam from criticism. The "all religions have extremists" fallacy is immeasurably deceptive. It is true that a minuscule number of Christian individuals have used their faith as a justification for attacking abortion providers in the United States over the past 25 years. People with functioning brains, though, recognize that the scale of a phenomenon matters. Even though Islam does not hold a monopoly on ideologically based violence, it is certainly much more conducive to violence than, say, the beliefs of extremist Jains, who would assiduously use a broom to ensure that they do not walk on ants. Boxing and bowling are both labeled as sports, and yet we do not presume that they have an equal likelihood of yielding injuries. All religions are not equal in their capacity to mete out violence and genocidal hate. To say otherwise is to be hopelessly misguided or profoundly duplicitous. Two other popular deflections are, "But what about the Crusades?" and, "But the Bible also has violent passages." The Crusades were a response to hundreds of years of Islamic aggression, and they took place within a very restricted time and place, nearly a millennium ago. As for the Bible, you can count on one hand the number of individuals who have used violent passages from Deuteronomy to justify acts of terrorism in the 21st century. On the other hand, innumerable jihadis around the world use Islamic doctrines to justify their violent actions. Scale matters. Another classic ploy used by apologists is the "no true Scotsman" fallacy. This argues that entire Islamic countries, Islamic governments, and leading Islamic scholars are, quote, fake representations of the true faith. If you point to Sharia law in Saudi Arabia, the retort is that this does not represent true Islam. Similarly, Iran's mullahs apparently do not represent true Islam. Osama bin Laden was a, quote, fake Muslim. Other fake Muslims include Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was on friendly terms with Adolf Hitler, Sheikh Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, arguably the leading Sunni theologian today, and Caliph Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the late leader of ISIS. Remember your friend Ahmed, who is gay, eats prosciutto, and drinks cognac? He is a real Muslim. All these others are fake. Denial is a very powerful trap. OPS sufferers also employ the infinite spiral of delegitimization strategy, meant to delegitimize your right to critique Islam. For most Westerners, it takes only one question: do you speak Arabic? But other questions might include, did you grow up in the Middle East? Are you a Muslim? Do you understand Quranic philology? Are you a Hafiz, someone who has memorized the Quran in its entirety? Did you attend Al-Azhar University, the supposed leading institution of Sunni Islam? Are you an imam? Or, if all else fails, are you one of the faithful companions of Muhammad? No? Well, shut up then. You don't have the right to criticize the noble faith. Given that Arabic is my mother tongue and that I'm from Lebanon, it takes longer to delegitimize me. Most Westerners don't stand a chance. A more subtle delegitimization strategy is to deflect any critical scrutiny of Islam by historical cliché. For instance, How do you explain the peaceful coexistence of Muslims, Jews, and Christians in Andalusia in the 15th century? One answer, and a perfectly acceptable one, is that, well, that was Andalusia in the 15th century. Let's talk about today. But most historical clichés trotted out by progressives are also false, and the Andalusian era of alleged peaceful coexistence is an historical myth. People of the book, Jews and Christians, were at times tolerated as second, if not third-class citizens, but they needed to know their place in the grand fabric of Islamic society. They held the status of a dhimmi, which required that they adhere to specific laws, including the payment of the jizya, protection tax. In Muslim societies, non-Muslims are tolerated until they are not, at which point you better run fast. You never know when this is going to happen, but you know that the looming metaphorical heart attack is just around the corner. My family lived in Lebanon under relative safety until the day that we had to run for our lives. In a quest to appear nuanced, many academics will posit that a given phenomenon, like global jihad, is due to a broad range of hyphenated and concatenated factors that represent a complex, multifactorial problem. I call this the concatenation strategy. I have often satirized this form of intellectual duplicity whenever another terror attack takes place with the perpetrators yelling, "Allahu Akbar." I remind people, satirically, that the true motives of the terrorists may never be known, but they are likely due to a confluence of paleobotanic, sociocultural, biopolitical, neurophysiological, psychoeconomic, heterohistorical, geoorganic, and ethno-ketogenic factors. The more nonsensical terms that you construe together, the greater the illusion of explanatory profundity. The nuanced enemies of reason also like to use euphemisms to cover realities that are too politically incorrect to name. Hence, the West is not fighting Islamic terror. Rather, we are combating radicalized, militant, violent, extremist, man-made fanaticism, the dreaded RMVEMMF ideology. Those who are a bit more honest will recognize that it is linked to Islam, but they will use the ism algorithm to sanitize the reality. Hence, it is not due to Islam, but Islamism. It's not Islam, but jihadism, Wahhabism, or Salafism. Or they will place a qualifier to draw a distinction between Islam and radical Islam or extremist Islam. Many people have a strong aversion to directly blaming Islam because it feels gauche or intolerant to do so. They would rather give Islam a pass and place the blame on some supposedly distorted version of the faith. The reality, though, is that there are no codified holy books of Islamism that are distinct from those of Islam. Islamism, the political element of Islam, is an integral element of the religion. Fortunately, a great majority of Muslims ignore the unpalatable parts of their religion. This does not mean that they are practicing some unicorn, gentle, true Islam. If Mordecai Rubenstein chooses to eat pork and shrimps, he is not practicing a more liberal form of Judaism. He is simply ignoring those elements of kosher laws that he finds too culinarily difficult to adhere to. When faced with the unsavory nature of many Islamic doctrines, progressives argue that these cannot be taken seriously because the interpretation of texts, hermeneutics, is a subjective exercise, and very clear Islamist edicts of genocidal hate have, we are told, been mistranslated, misinterpreted, and misunderstood. I call this the holy 3M of apologia. Using the political philosophy of multiculturalism, OPS sufferers refrain from criticizing truly abhorrent cultural and religious practices such as female genital mutilation, child brides, and honor killings under the guise of moral and cultural relativism. It is apparently wrong to apply universal moral principles when judging the precepts of a given society. Thus, Western critics are silent, if not supportive, of cultural and religious practices that otherwise should be universally condemned, as it would be racist and bigoted to question the traditions of others. Indeed, before he became Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau declared himself angrier that such practices could be declared barbaric than he was at the practices themselves. Radical Western feminists grant cover to such horrifying abuses of women under a similarly misguided notion of cultural relativism. In such a convoluted worldview, the burqa, the niqab, and the hijab become symbols of female empowerment, while the bikini is construed as a symbol of patriarchal oppression. Using the hierarchy of victimhood, OPS sufferers refuse to criticize Islam because it would be, quote, gross and racist, to utilize Ben Affleck's infamous words. Instead, they fetishize all Muslims as inherently noble, peaceful, and kind, a new manifestation of the myth of the noble savage. All brown people are lovely, while the white man is to blame for all ills. I once shared a clip on my personal Facebook page of an Iraqi astronomer arguing that, according to Islamic scriptures, the earth was indeed flat. I received an irate reply from a white Western, quote, progressive female scientist who chastised me for sharing such a story. In her view, we should be nicer to Muslims. Hence, a fellow scientist was not angered by the nonsense that this Iraqi gentleman was spewing. Instead, she was upset at my having shared his idiocy. In her quest to be politically correct, she was willing to kill the truth. In his book, That's Offensive, Stefan Collini addresses the misguided progressive desire to shield some groups from equal scrutiny. Similar arguments apply to attempts to exempt the views or tastes of any group from reasoned appraisal and measured judgment. However well-intentioned, all such attempts are, in the end, condescending. They assume that, in relation to a given topic, those who are in a disadvantaged, quote, minority, we are all in minorities in relation to certain topics, need, in addition to efforts to remedy their disadvantage, the further protection of not having their most cherished convictions critically scrutinized. This, in effect, posits a two-tier society intellectually, with the grown-ups deciding not just what may or may not be said in front of the children, but who are to count as children in the first place. This eventually engenders a situation in which it is considered acceptable to criticize, mock, or give offense to those deemed to be among the privileged, but not to those deemed to be among the less privileged, a moral asymmetry which is ultimately corrosive of genuine respect and equality. Is Sharia law consistent with Western legal standards? If one had to identify the legal system most antithetical to the American one, Sharia law fits that bill, and yet many OPS sufferers will argue otherwise. Many Westerners might be repulsed by Sharia's extraordinarily harsh corporeal punishments for theft, cutting off the hand, and adultery, stoning. And you might think that the lower status of women when it comes to the validity of their legal testimony or their bequeathing rights, half that of men, might be grotesque to Western sensibilities. Surely most Westerners would find it astoundingly cruel and unjust, if not insane, that under Sharia law, a female rape victim needs the eyewitness testimony of four men to be believed. But Sharia law is even more fundamentally opposed to Western legal standards because Islam rejects the Western idea of impartial justice applied fairly regardless of an individual's identity. Under Sharia, punishments are applied as a function of the identity of the victim and perpetrator. A Jewish man who kills a Muslim man is judged very differently than a Muslim man who kills a Jewish man. Sharia law specifically states that no retaliation can take place when a Muslim kills a non-Muslim, and that indemnities depend on the identities of the parties in question. 04.9a. For the rulings below, one multiplies the fraction named by the indemnity appropriate to the death or injuries type of intentionality and other relevant circumstances that determine the amount of a male Muslim's indemnity. Definitions 04.2-6 and 04.13. The indemnity for the death or injury of a woman is one half the indemnity paid for a man. The indemnity paid for a Jew or Christian is one third of the indemnity paid for a Muslim. The indemnity paid for a Zoroastrian is one fifteenth of that of a Muslim. This is what identity politics does to a legal system, and this is precisely the standard adhered to by progressives. Men can be sexist, but women can't be. Whites can be racist, but blacks can't be. Permissible speech is governed by identity and political allegiance. A straight white Christian conservative man should shut his mouth and cede the floor to the progressive, Muslim indigenous trans woman of color. Know your place, white guy. Don't speak out of turn. Hence, it is true that both Sharia law and progressive identity politics adhere to the exact same principle. The repercussions of this fundamental attack on individual rights manifest themselves differently across the two ecosystems, but the mindset is nearly identical. The only difference is that progressives uphold the idea of equality, which Sharia law does not. Still, progressive equality is a very special kind of equality. It was best captured in the immortal words of George Orwell in his novel Animal Farm. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Profiling is racist. I spent the summers of 1983 and 1984 in Israel, where many members of my extended family live. On one trip, I was detained at the border and eventually called in for questioning because I was a young man born in Lebanon. I tried to explain that I was a Lebanese Jew with extensive family in Israel. The Israeli agent noted my family members' names. My eldest brother is Moshe, or Moses in English, and my name is a biblical Hebrew name, and asked me in Hebrew if I were Jewish, and the matter was quickly resolved. In 1999, I returned to Israel to present a paper at a conference. During that visit, I took a short break in Dahab, Egyptian Sinai. When I re-entered Israel, I was once again interrogated. The Israeli agent wanted proof that I was a professor and holder of a PhD, to which I responded that I was not in the habit of carrying my doctoral diploma with me, but the matter was quickly resolved. More recently, and closer to home, I was detained at the American border for more than 1 hour as I tried to make my way to Clarkson University to deliver an invited lecture. I was traveling with my wife and young daughter, who was then 2 years old. The delay was an inconvenience, but in the big picture, a minor one. I bring these incidents up to ask a question. Are the Israelis and Americans raging racists who are targeting an innocent, olive-skinned Middle Eastern man? Are they vile bigots engaging in a discriminatory form of profiling? The answer is an unequivocal yes if you've been infected with OPS. It is a no for anyone with a functioning brain. If a dark alley offered a shortcut on your way home, would you be more or less likely to take it if you noticed four young men or four elderly women loitering there? Using common sense, you realize that young men are more likely to be dangerous than elderly women, and you might go another way if you saw the young men. This does not make you sexist or ageist. Most young men are not violent, but there is a greater possibility that they could be, which warrants trepidation. Back in 1993, a rabid white racist uttered the following infamous words: "There is nothing more painful to me at this stage of my life than to walk down the street and hear footsteps and start thinking about robbery. Then I look around and see someone white and feel relieved." Oh no, wait. That was no grand wizard of the KKK. It was none other than African-American activist Jesse Jackson. Does the Reverend Jackson suffer from internalized bigotry against his own race? Or perhaps he recognizes race-based patterns of criminality based on aggregate data and responds accordingly. In my first semester as a doctoral student at Cornell University, I read Homicide, a book authored by two of the leading figures of evolutionary psychology, which had a profound effect on my eventual scientific career. In it, the authors use the evolutionary lens to analyze a broad range of criminal behavior, including child abuse and domestic violence. Two of the breathtaking conclusions arising from their analyses are: 1, the best predictor of whether a child will be abused, by a factor of 100, is whether the child grows up with a step-parent, dubbed the Cinderella effect, and 2, the most dangerous person in a woman's life is her male partner. Specifically, men are driven to violent actions when they suspect or become aware of infidelity. These are universal facts that transcend culture and time precisely because they are rooted in an evolutionary calculus that shapes dark elements of our shared human nature. It is not surprising, then, that when the police investigate a woman's murder, The first person they consider as a suspect is the male partner. They know perfectly well that most men will never commit such acts, but the police also know the odds, by experience, if nothing else, that justify their actions. Similarly, the Cinderella effect holds true, notwithstanding the obvious existence of loving and caring stepparents. Personal anecdotes do not invalidate these statistical realities. Our brains have evolved to detect statistical regularities in our environment. To act on this knowledge is not bigoted, racist, or hateful. It is at the root of human cognition. To discriminate, in the sense of making a distinction rooted in a probabilistic reality, is to be human. To profile is to be human. Those infected with OPS reject this logic. Instead, in the desire to adhere to the reality is racist tenets of progressivism, they refuse to profile because to do so would be discriminatory, in the prejudicial sense of the word. They belong to what the political humorist Evan Sayette referred to as the cult of indiscriminateness. This is precisely why, when traveling to Southern California in 2011, my then 2-year-old daughter was randomly chosen for a more thorough security check at the Montreal airport. It is precisely why a posse of elderly nuns would be just as likely to be picked for an enhanced security check as a group of young men from Pakistan, Yemen, and Syria traveling together. In Unicornia, all people are just as likely to be terrorists. To think otherwise is to be a hateful bigot. OPS is a terrible affliction of the human mind. Chapter 7. How to Seek Truth. Nomological Networks of Cumulative Evidence. One of the most salient features of our culture is that there is so much bullshit. Everyone knows this. Harry G. Frankfurt. Reason, we argue, has two main functions, that of producing reasons for justifying oneself and that of producing arguments to convince others. Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber. A fundamental feature of an individual's civic duty in a free society is to be an informed citizen on issues of societal import. This is not an easy